Okay, Francis, over to you.
Alrighty. Well, hello, friends. Welcome to this fifth webinar on the Light of the Soul. I hope you were able to pick up at least some of the conference, if not all of it. It was a terrific conference, and it's not over yet. Next month, there's going to be two, I don't know what to call them now, post conferences. On rheology and astrology, so hope you can sign up for those as well. All right, well, we started our last session by taking a look at the second sutra of Book One, which states this union or yoga is achieved through the subjugation of the psychic nature and the restraint of the citta or mind. This verse represents a kind of mission statement for the entire book, actually. Having defined the goal of Raja Yoga in the first sutra, Patanjali now defines the twofold task required to achieve that goal, which are subjugation of the psychic nature and restraint of the citta or mind. Immediately following the sutra, come two clarifying points. One, to gain control of the versatile psychic nature. These are terms we're going to gradually become super used to because they happen throughout the book. The versatile psychic nature, and to prevent the mind from assuming the many forms it so easily does. These are frequently called modifications of the thinking principle. Okay, the versatile psychic nature is Kama manas, or desire mind, the substance that clothes all desires and feelings, allowing them to be expressed. Versatile refers to the fact that kama, the vehicle of desire, constantly changes shape, fluctuating with every mood, feeling, and longing. Uncontrolled desire, quote, shuts out the light of the soul and negates spiritual consciousness. Modifications of the thinking principle, called vrittis in Sanskrit, are the near infinite possible adaptations of citta, or mind stuff, in order that it can take the form of one's thoughts, hence the term thought forms. We then learned that these two aspects of personality life, the versatile psychic nature and the ability of citta or mind stuff to instantaneously provide a form for our thoughts, control both our astral and mental lives. And that this dual activity, and here's the important part, shuts off the light of the soul and negates spiritual consciousness. Next, AAB tells us that union is impossible as long as the barriers created by the versatile psychic nature and the constantly changing thought forms exist. And then introduces the idea that there is practical work that will liberate the light so that it may shine forth in a dark place. That dark place being the physical plane. And that this particular work, which is contained in the sutras, will lead to control over the lower nature so that it can manifest the higher. This is an alchemical process where personal desire first becomes aspiration and then love. We're then taught that just as calming the astral vehicle creates a astral to soul love line, restraining the mind creates a mental to spirit line, and the will aspect of the ego can then be known. AAB then gives us these two lines of least resistance in chart form, which articulate the upward extension of the astral and mental lines as shown here. We then learned that the student is given the word of restraint or control as a key to all his endeavors. suggesting that a mantram is given, sometimes during the course of one's instruction, that carries a particular vibratory frequency capable of restraining one's citta. Then, after more info on citta and the psychic nature, we're told that the elemental lives that make up the substance of the lower mental and astral bodies have their own line of evolution to follow, and they do so. Since that line is involutional, shown here, it works counter to our evolutionary process. This brings us to the third sutra, which states, when this has been accomplished, the yogi knows himself as he is in reality. So knowing oneself as you are in reality suggests that previously the indweller knew him or herself as a personality, almost totally conditioned by astral glamour and mental illusion. AAB then gives us six progressive steps, which form the sum total of her commentary on this third sutra. The first, sees the self, comes about when the two conditions before described, gaining control of the versatile psychic nature and restraining the mind, are met. Gained on astral levels through non-attachment, and on mental levels through use of the word of restraint. Then the inner eye opens and sees what in Sanskrit is called the drashta, which means the soul in its capacity as the observer. So you see the soul observing you, so to speak. But the next step realizes the true nature of the soul. We move from vision of the soul to knowing the nature or quality of the soul. The three aspects of this knowing are sat, or being, recognition that the soul is immortal and permanent, chit, or consciousness, which comes directly through the intuition, and ananda, which is a state of causeless joy, just innate, continuous joy. So you'll often hear this term sat chit ananda, which represents soul consciousness. And then three, identifies himself with the inner reality, no longer with the concealing forms. So seeing, then perceiving, and now identification. The yogi withdraws his or her sense of self from the personality to the soul, thereby moving his or her center of gravity from the form aspect to the spirit. So as I continue here, I want to invite you to make comments and ask any questions. If anything is unclear, please raise your hand. We'll call on you. And because often, you know, discourse is more interesting than simply monologue. I see we have a hand right off. Heidi?
Hold on a second. Yeah, thanks.
Okay. Thank you very much. I just wanted to make mention to what came to me was the intuition, which it, that goes through the emotion, has this flow to it. And the way of the mind is more about controlling the atomic, the Atman, or the particulate matter. So I was just like kind of seeing the, those two ways that were talked about, the intuitional flow that comes through.
Right.
And then the atomic, which is more mental and also to, has to do with restraint and control of that particulate matter that is, yeah, that's moving through. Actually, somehow I don't see them as separate, but is moving through that intuitional presencing, I'll call it. But anyway, you can make comments about that.
Yeah, they're the yin yang of the whole, you know. They're both. When you said you don't see them as separate, that's exactly right. They can be described in a separative way, but they one doesn't actually work without the other. You know, in the same way that the second, fourth, and sixth rays are inherent in the expression of the first, third, fifth, and seventh rays, that they form together a completion, but they can be described. You could say their coloration can be described separately, right? I will make one correction. It's our use of the word intuition is very loose in general speech. It's not a criticism, it's just identifying how people in daily speech use the intuition as and it's really the sense of impression. Because this book parses these qualities very specifically, I have to say that, and I'll be describing this later on, that true intuition is only exists on the Buddhic plane and through Buddhic impression. One must, in a sense, be Buddhically aware to actually receive the intuition that as it truly is in DK's, the Master DK's teaching. But in terms of the of that flow that you're describing, that sense of unified just knowingness, the higher subplanes of the astral plane can often give you that. It's just a looser form of the term. Okay, anyone else? All right, third identifies himself the reality. And seeing, oh, I said this, the yogi withdraws his or her sense from personality to soul and moves his center of gravity towards spirit. Four, dwells in the center and no longer upon the periphery. And this use of the symbol, you know, the point, the circle with the point in the center, the periphery represents the cycle of birth and rebirth, the senses and the outer world in general, all characteristics of the realm of the personality. In contrast, the point in the center represents the soul who sends a series of personalities out to the periphery in order to gain experience, but whose intrinsic nature is stillness. Dwelling in the center comes through identification with the soul. Of course, and there are many other ways in which this point at the center of the circle, the symbol of this is used. I'd say it represents literally the symbol for the solar logos, as well as for any atom within the solar ring pass knot, because you also have always have the that point of spirit, the life aspect at the center, and then the boundary of its influence, its own ring pass knot. So there's many ways in which this symbol is used, but here it specifically represents the soul at the center and the personality cycle of births and rebirths, senses, etc., as the periphery. Next. Five, achieves spiritual consciousness. In the Bali teaching, spiritual consciousness refers to the ever-unfolding awareness of the unity of all life, first through group or soul consciousness, and later through synthetic or monadic consciousness. In this list, it represents the I am that consciousness, right, which we find demonstrated in Aquarius. It's even though it's stated in Leo, as part of the esoteric keywords, right? And finally, six awakes to recognition of the God within. Here, the word awakes implies that normal human life is a dream state. We are dreaming that we are mortal, separate beings. The yogi doesn't become God, he simply wakes up from the dream of being a separated personality to recognition, which implies remembrance of the God within. AAB then describes the progression from Sutras 1 to 3, from 1 to 3. Quote, "The aspirant faces his problem, the clue to its solution is given to him, and the reward, union with the soul, is held before his seeking eye." Here are the three sutras, the first three sutras of Book One. The aspirant faces his problem, references the first sutra. The clue to a solution is given to him, is represented by the second. And the reward, union with the soul, is held before his seeking eye. It's described in the commentary on the third verse. No techniques are yet given. These are almost like section titles for the book, right? They just state the in broad strokes the three stages of approach, engagement, and triumph. We then got into the fourth sutra, quote, "Up till now, the inner man has identified himself with his forms and with their active modifications." That's always key recognition for you when you hear that, active modifications, you know. The phrase "up till now" actually covers millions of years of evolution. During all our previous lives, we have identified with our physical bodies, emotions, and lower mind. Active modifications, called chitta-vrittis in Sanskrit, refers to the waves on the surface of the mind stuff. Bailey then gives a more in-depth description of the elementals who make up the astral and mental sheaths. Quote, "Their objective is, however, different from that of the inner man, and they hinder his progress and self-realization. He becomes enmeshed in their activities and must free himself before he comes into his heritage of power and peace and bliss." A bit later, she continues, quote, "The lower forms are constantly and ceaselessly active, endlessly assuming the forms of impulsive desires or dynamic mental thought forms. And it is only as this form-taking is controlled and the tumult of the lower nature is stilled that it becomes possible for the inner ruling entity to liberate himself from the thraldom and impose his vibration upon the lower modifications." So, using the words constantly, ceaselessly, endlessly, AAB emphasizes the relentlessness of our lower nature. This is because the natural state of the little lives that make up our three sheaths is sustained by impulsive desire and thought form generation, which together create tumult. Any thoughts or questions? Okay, the concept of form taking, which is the literal translation of the Sanskrit word vritti, is interesting. Chitta or mind stuff has no shape of its own. It's like water. It takes the shape of whatever is presented to it. If you think of a person, the mind takes the form of that person. If you think of an enemy, the mind not only takes that form, but also constructs the form of anger or fear in the astral body. As long as the mind is busy taking these lower forms, it cannot take the form of the soul, which is why we have to impose the vibration of the quote, inner ruling entity upon the lower modifications. And this, basically, this book is about how to do that. Finally, after describing the nature of the barrier to soul light, AAB begins to teach us how these barriers can be overcome. Quote, "This is achieved through concentration, the concentrated effort of the soul to hold steadily the position of observer or perceiver and seer." We usually think of concentration as the mind focusing in on some idea or object, but the concentration here described arises from the soul, who impresses on the indwelling jiva the point of stillness in the center of the circle of personality activity, which AAB here calls holding steadily the position of observer or perceiver and of seer. What's somewhat of a shift from what we might normally think is that we're really tuning into the soul's concentration, right? We just still ourselves enough so that the concentrated effort of the soul can hold us steadily at the central point. It's in this way that the quote, lower spectacle of the rapidly changing forms of thought and desire fades away, and the realm of the soul, the true field of soul knowledge, can be seen and contacted. We then took a look at the fifth sutra of book one. The mind's states are five and are subtle, are subject to pleasure or pain. They are painful or not painful. The good news here is that the modifications of the mind are not an infinite chaos. In fact, every movement of the mind fits into one of five categories, which are listed in the next sutra. In addition, all thoughts are either painful or not painful. That's really the statement being made in this sutra, this duality of painful or not painful. Painful thoughts, called kleshta in Sanskrit, increase the darkness because they reinforce the separated self. Positive or quote unquote not painful thoughts, called akleshta, move us towards liberation. Though eventually both types of thoughts have to be transcended. And that pretty much takes us up to where we left off last time. So we'll start this section with a continued commentary on the fifth sutra. Could we get a reader, please?
I'll start us off today.
Good.
All activity in the lower nature is the result of kama manas, or the mind hinged with feeling, of the desire will of the lower man. The goal of the Raja Yoga system is that these impulses should be replaced by the considered intelligent action of the soul or spiritual man, whose nature is love, whose acts are wise, occultly understood, and whose motive is group development. Therefore, that reaction called pain must be transcended, and likewise that termed pleasure, for both of these are dependent upon identification with form. Non-attachment must supersede them. It is interesting to note that the modification of the internal organ, the mind, are five in number, manas, or mind, the actuating principle of the citta, or mind stuff, is the fifth principle, and like all else in nature, manifests as a duality. The duality is the lower concrete mind, demonstrating as the activity of the mental body, and the abstract mind, demonstrating as the lowest aspect of the ego.
Thank you, BL. Okay, first, all activity in the lower nature is the result of kama manas, or of mind tinged with feeling. That's an important definition, right? You know, you can't have emotion without mind. Even though it may be the simplest little thought form, and then this flood of feeling, so much so that you don't even remember the initial thought form, but it's always activated. The astral feeling quality is always activated by mind. Okay, mind tinged with feeling of the desire will of the lower man. The goal of the Raja Yoga system is that these impulses should be replaced by the considered intelligent action of the soul or spiritual man, whose nature is love, whose acts are wise, occultly understood, and whose motive is group development. So we're here given a trinity of qualities that characterize the spiritual man, and also that describe how we move beyond kama manas. And they are love, wisdom, and that decentralizing force that leads to group identification. You could call it self-forgetfulness or decentralization, all of which reflect a person's shift from the astrally driven personality to a soul-centered disciple. But we might ask, what is the specific nature of the energy associated with each of these qualities that allows one to break the hold of kama manas? I mean, you know, it's great to read these words, but it doesn't, you know, we need to take a closer look at just what these qualities are and what is it about them that allow them to triumph over the lower nature. So, you know, we talk a lot about love, but what are the energetic qualities associated with love that actually enable it to defeat the kama manasic impulse? First, the soul uses magnetism to draw the chaotic lower personality vehicles into alignment. So magnetism is a very important element and the response mechanism. Then again, through the soul's magnetic potency, the coarse matter animated by kama manas, being incompatible with the soul's high vibration, is gradually shaken loose and expelled from the aspirant's lower vehicles. As this coarse matter is driven out, the soul draws in high-grade matter from the surrounding energetic environment. In this way, the astral body is rebuilt with matter that responds to universal love rather than to personal emotion. So it goes all the way down to the response of matter to the law of attraction and magnetism that emanates from the soul. Once we start responding to the soul, then this great purging process begins, right? And it ends up in conscious awareness of the love aspect. Mental body is rebuilt with matter that can hold the light of the intuition rather than just concrete facts. Also, when the magnetic field of the soul is brought to bear on the personality, it realigns every atom in such a way that the positive pole is magnetically oriented towards the soul, resulting in eventual transparency of the lower sheaths. And this happens as a result of the gradual replacement of the atoms of matter until you, as a third initiate, I think DK tells us we're 75% atomic matter, which suggests that at the fourth initiation that we're 100% atomic matter, and then we break, we can shatter the causal body and move into cosmic consciousness. But and during this soul process, which is what this book is about, this love aspect is defined in terms of magnetism and the law of attraction transforming our astral and mental vehicles until we are able to become literally soul infused. Okay, let's see. Okay, secondly, the considered, I bumped my computer here, so I have to find myself here. Oh, yeah, here we are. Okay. All right. So, secondly, the considered intelligent action of the soul or spiritual man whose nature is love, whose acts are wise, occultly understood. So, like love, wisdom is a specific frequency of energy that originates from the intuition on the Buddhic plane and makes its way to the brain of the disciple via the Antahkarana. Intuition operates through the law of unity. When Buddhic energy, which DK describes as a universal solvent, is that creates a perfect sympathetic resonance. When this energy flows, the gap between the knower and the known closes, and the seeker and that which is being sought become one. In this instant, one's self-awareness expands to include all aspects of reality of that which is being, quote unquote, intuited, right? So this is the occult definition of being wise, which is having access to the intuition and therefore being one with that which is to be known, right? Where the knower and known become one. Then finally, the considered intelligent action of the soul or spiritual man whose nature is love, whose acts are wise, and whose motive is group development. So when the high frequency Buddhic energy of love wisdom flows down the Antahkarana, its rapid vibration dissolves the dense ring pass knot of personality and thus transfers the center of gravity to the heart center, which in turn allows the disciple to align with the soul's energetic nature, which is that of an ashram or group lotus. This soul collective literally functions within the energetic field of quote unquote group development, right? Soul development is group development, is ashramic development. The thing here that we have to remember in all these stages, we are naturally oriented towards a from the bottom up, a grassroots process, like I'm going to transfer the energy from the solar plexus to the heart by God, and you meditate and you visualize. But really, the process is top down, that you open yourself to that magnetism that flows downward from the concentrating soul. And then that's what does the work. What you want to do is hold the point in the center of the circle. You want to hold that point of stillness so that you can be uplifted, And that, as we described, that takes, There's a particular process by which that happens, like the replacement of the denser matter with finer matter. All of this allows for that veil to be lifted, and it's progressive because once you get a touch of the soul presence, then that opens a channel. DK says something like, if the tis the thinnest thread of the Antahkarana is attached to the higher end, that in a sense the whole thing is then established. What's the word I want? That the destiny of the Antahkarana being built is determined just by that attaching of that single thread to the higher, to the far shore, you could say, right? And then in a way, it's a done deal. It's guaranteed, though it then takes time, for all these transferences to take place, right? And the last of these is, just as described here, is group development, which is the I am that principle. Okay, any thoughts or questions so far? Are you staying with this material? Yes,
We
Nisa.
got.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Nisa.
Was wondering, I can't remember where I saw a video and or it might have been something Dwayne put forth or and read something, but it was an article on what's the plasma that could have even been that
Oh, yeah.
Burns fellow, the geologist and everything. But talking about plasma, and then they were talking about, and I'm kind of putting a mishmash of things in my mind together, but they were talking about magnetism and that there's some new magnetism that doesn't have two poles, it only has one, but that the second pole is actually like not on this physical plane. It and I can't even begin to, because it was at the limit of my ability to understand physics and beyond. But it was, and what came to me is that it was like a vortex, created between the two. If you want, I have to say points, even though the other one's like in a different dimension. But I'm just wondering if this is kind of on the forefront of what we're scientifically moving into to prove, in a kind of like for the physical dual mind to give people a push up into the higher dimensions and actually move forward. But it's just what kept coming to my mind as you were talking about this plasma substance that actually fills space. And that I guess somebody said it was, space was like 99.9% of this
Plasma, right?
stuff. And so I'm just wondering how that, what your
Yeah.
take
Well,
is
you're
on.
talking about the threshold in everything you said. You're talking about the threshold between the higher and the lower. Rose Bates, was her presentation there where she introduced the plasma and the idea that it sits at the threshold of the fourth ether. It's literally at the boundary of the fifth and fourth subplanes of the cosmic physical plane. And I'm sure there's an astral correspondence and a mental correspondence of plasma, but we've actually been able to discover and measure this physical phenomena of plasma, and it occultly, you're not going to get a scientist to say that that it forms the border of the fourth subplane of the physical plane, but that it suggests that it acts as a gateway between the etheric and physical. So that's what's exciting about it to occultists. And then your idea about the poles, that and I just said this here that this vortex, and this is described, this magnetism creates a vortex, an energetic vortex between the soul and the personality. And you could say that when that center space of a vortex is finally opened, then you have soul contact. Then it closes again, opens, closes, and but eventually it stays open, and the energy then has completely transformed all the material of your lower quaternary, and you're and at that point, I think the transference that is in process is definitely the solar plexus to the heart chakra, right? Which is the seed of the soul in the in a human being, right? So let's see, what else did you talk about? Those are a few of the ideas. Yeah, I think the idea of magnetism with only one pole, I don't know the thinking behind that, but generally speaking, that's not possible, right? That there has to be polarity for magnetism to even exist,
No, it was a recent article about some, current magnetic state that was unipolar, but that in point
unipolar.
of fact, the other pole was in another dimension somehow.
Okay. Now that's absolutely true. We already have that with the soul and the personality. The soul is definitely, in another dimension from the personality, because it's that what do they call it? The Leia point is between the fourth subplane, the mental plane and above. Or actually the third subplane of the mental plane and above, that's the Leia center where you cross at least one definition of this. From another point of view, it's reach the Leia center until you are leaving the cosmic physical plane. But in terms of soul personality relationship, that's the Leia point. So yes, the positive point is in another dimension at that point. And in fact, I think esoterically, that's always going to be the case because that's the definition of the path of becoming, is that the positive point lie beyond the state of being that you currently inhabit, right? Okay, good one. I saw there was a second hand. Are they still up? You see Ron's hand.
Yes,
Yes, but
and
Heidi had. Oh, go
okay,
ahead.
go ahead.
Go ahead. Well, I was having a problem too with that monopolar magnet. How can that be? When you have that attraction going on for two, or if they're all the same pole, then they're all repelling each other.
Yeah, it doesn't really, no, it doesn't really work. Or they're all attracting each other. The thing is, what's being attracted or what's being repelled? It's a function of duality inherently. Now, it can seem unipolar if the positive pole is in another, quote unquote, another dimension, speaking occultly, not in terms of physical science, then it can seem like there's only one pole you could say is visible, but no, I think we're talking about just a higher positive pole.
Thank you.
Yeah. And was it Heidi that had her
Yeah,
hand?
Heidi had her hand up. Heidi, did you want to say something?
I think the only thing I really wanted to say was it's this that in that transition from the lower mind, and depending on how people recognize it, it can actually look like a destruction. But really, what it is it's actually an opening and a transformation of what has been known to the, you could say, to the personality,
Right.
and the personality actually has to relax its state, which actually opens a space. And in that spaciousness of the relaxed personality, so the personality relaxes itself so that the soul actually has the ability to really influence that the life and the nature of the life. It actually influences the whole thing then, but it actually has to happen through that relaxing, which is a type of releasing, and an opening which creates that spaciousness for the soul to actually influence the life.
Right. Yeah, that's right. It's well said. When you focus, even when in DK's words you create a point of tension, this is done through the necessary stages before that happens, is what you're calling relaxing the personality, which is basically quieting both the versatile psychic nature and the modifications of the mind completely into quiescence, and then the soul gets through, right? And all the processes that we've been describing be it begin or continue. The transformational process continues. That's a way of defining meditation, right? You relax your personality so that that inner vortex, the inner part of the vortex opens up a channel to between personality and soul. Thank you for that. Anybody else?
I think that's all I see for right now.
Okay. Next up, therefore, that reaction called pain must be transcended, and likewise that termed pleasure. For both of these are dependent upon identification with form. Non-attachment must supersede them. Okay, so pain and pleasure are automatic responses of the lower vehicle to outside impacts. The personality believes that moving from pain to pleasure is progressive. When in fact, as long as one is experiencing either, that person is still being controlled by their outer environment. They are reacting rather than acting because they are still identified with the form world. The solution is to withdraw this identification through what's called divine detachment. By holding the consciousness steadily within the soul, thereby enabling the lower bodies to perform their soul-inspired duties in the world, which is called service, right? Soul is the spontaneous effect of, I mean, service is the spontaneous effect of soul contact. Remember that definition? Yeah, this is how that happens. A soul identified initiate still feels physical pain, but there is no attendant psychological suffering. It's an important point. He or she also feels pleasure, but now as a pure, harmonious, soul-aligned vibration, rather than as a physical, astral, or mental stimulant, right? You could call them joy and bliss, happiness, that triad of happiness, joy, and bliss, that that pleasure would be the sole experience of pleasure would be joy and bliss. Okay, and then finally, it's interesting to note that the modifications of the internal organ, the mind, are five in number. Manas, or mind, the actuating principle of the citta, or mind stuff, is the fifth principle, and like all else in nature, manifests as a duality. This duality is lower concrete mind, demonstrating as the activity of the mental body, and abstract mind, demonstrating as the lowest aspect of the ego, which means soul. So, citta is the passive, subtle matter of the mental plane. Manas is the active electrical principle that hits, impacts that matter and causes it to move. Because this actuating principle is driven by the energy that expresses itself through the number five, the resulting ripples or modifications naturally group themselves into five categories. You study DK long enough, you see more and more the absolute orientation to number that all classifications have. This is also why, Manas is on the fifth plane. We're talking about the fifth ray of concrete knowledge. But the most important point here is that the mind is actually two different organs operating on two different levels. The mental body of the personality, which deals with form, separation, and analysis, and the abstract mind, the lowest tier of the spiritual triad, demonstrating as the lowest aspect of the soul, which is composed of the high frequency spiritual light called solar fire. This self-generating perpetual radiance is the native environment of the ego. Abstract mind is the environment of the soul, right? And it is infused with solar fire, which is the nature of and how the higher mind or abstract mind demonstrates. Okay, any thoughts? Okay, we need a reader for the next passage.
Scott, can you read that for us, please?
Here we go. In the microcosm, man, this duality becomes a triple modification upon the mental plane. And in these three, we have in miniature a picture of the macrocosmic manifestation. These three are: one, the mental permanent atom, the lowest aspect of the spiritual triad or of the soul. Two, the egoic body, the causal body, or the karana cerebra. Three, the mental body, the highest aspect of the lower personal self. The mental body itself has five modifications or activities, and thus is a reflection or correspondence of the fifth principle, as it manifests upon the fifth plane, the mental. The modifications are the lower shadow of manas, or mind in the microcosmic manifestation. And this mind is a reflection of Mahat, the universal mind, or mind manifesting in the macrocosm. This is a great mystery. Oop. But will reveal itself to the man who overcomes the five modifications of the lower mind, who through non-attachment to the lower,
identifies himself with a higher, and who thus solves the mystery of the Makara and treads the way of the Kumaras.
Thank you, Scott. Okay, first, in the microcosm, man, this duality becomes a triple modification upon the mental plane. And in these three, we have in miniature a picture of the macrocosmic manifestation. These three are the mental permanent atom, the lowest aspect of the spiritual triad order of the soul, the egoic body, the causal body, or the karana asharira, and three, the mental body, the highest aspect of the lower personal self. So here we have the three aspects of the mental plane. The mental permanent atom is a single indestructible atom made of the highest grade for subplane mental substance. It acts as the upper anchor of the antikarana for the spiritual triad on the highest subplane of the mental plane. But its primary function is to act as the point of reception by which the monad is able to comprehend the abstract mathematics and archetypal blueprints of the divine plan as they are come into mental demonstration on the monastic plane. Right? So it's interesting that the monad draws from above to below, draws on the monastic permanent atom as a means of gaining awareness of the archetypal blueprints of the divine plan. It's kind of the reverse of what we normally would think, you know, that it's always the low that draws on the higher, right? But here we have an example of how the monad dips down into its third aspect via the monastic permanent atom. The middle principle, it's the causal body, or karana sharira. This is the actual form of the soul on its own plane, a radiant, the form of the soul, not the soul itself, but the form of the soul, a radiant 12-petaled lotus built of solar fire, which holds all our good karma, extracted wisdom, and the purified love from previous lifetimes. The mental body is both the lowest aspect of the mental trinity and the highest aspect of the lower personal self. It is an active, vibrating field of mental matter that surrounds our physical brains. The core of the mental body is the mental unit, which records the specific vibrational frequencies of our concrete intellect from life to life. You know, the astral permanent atoms records the function of the astral body and the physical of the physical body. So you would think, oh, well, the monastic permanent atom records the mental activity from life to life. But no, that is beyond the soul incarnating principle, the, you know, where the soul incarnates personalities. And so the receptacle, like a permanent atom, is the mental unit. Okay. Any thoughts, questions? Okay, next, the mental body itself has my five modification or activities, and thus as a reflection or correspondence of the fifth principle as it manifests upon the fifth plane, the mental. So AAB again emphasizes the as above, so below principle, here linking the archetypal universal fifth principle of manas to the demonstration of that principle through the quote, five modifications or activities on the systemic mental plane. That's also called the shadow of manas. Next, the modifications are the lower shadow. Well, there it is. Of manas, or mind in the microcosmic manifestation. And this mind is a reflection of Mahat, the universal mind, or mind manifesting in the macrocosm. So the macrocosmic source of mind, called Mahat, is the vast unconditioned intelligence that permeates and structures the entire cosmos, and is thus the ultimate matrix of form. The lower reflection of this, and Mahat, it, for our solar system, emanates from the Pleiades. It's the, you could say, the highest demonstration of intelligent activity of matter, right? The lower reflection of this source or of divine ideation is manas, a localized focal point of that mahatic universal intelligence, which is anchored within each human being, made available to them through the Manasaputras, who implanted the spark of mind at individualization. Finally, this is a great mystery, but will reveal itself to the man who overcomes the five modifications of the lower mind, who, through non-attachment to the lower, identifies himself with the higher, and who thus solves the mystery of the Makara and treads the way of the Kumaras. So, as long as lower manas generates the five types of modifications, the brain is too preoccupied to register the subtler vibratory qualities of the soul. The only way out of this orientation is to respond to the magnetic updraft of the soul, which allows one to withdraw the indweller's energy or attention from lower mental activity through non-attachment, which then eventually results in a soul identification. The mystery of the Makara is inextricably tied to fiveness, symbolized by the upright and reversed pentagrams. In fact, the five points of the reversed pentagram exactly correspond to the five modifications of the lower mind. When the disciple masters his or her fivefold lower nature, the inverted pentagram of the personality flips to its upright position, where it becomes the radiant star of the initiated spiritual man. To tread the way of the Kumaras is to participate in their sacrifice. Once the yogi solves the mystery of Makara and perfects their own monastic vehicle, they step back into the world of form to serve as conscious light bearers, using their now illumined minds to serve humanity. That just touches on this. You know, this is a very deep hole to dive into, this Makara Kumara mystery. It's very much connected with, not just with the number five, but also the constellation Capricorn, which is, of course, whose number is 10, and DK points out, is twice five. Okay, next up, could we get a reader, please? We're going to be moving into the sixth sutra here.
Heidi, can you read that for us, please?
Yes, I think I can. Okay. Herein lies a hint to the more advanced students of this science as to the esoteric problem of the Makara, hinted at in the secret doctrine of H.B. Blavatsky. These modifications, activities, are correct knowledge, incorrect knowledge, fancy passivity or sleep, and memory. There exists a vast field of knowledge which the seer must cognize at some time or another. It is generally conceded among occult psychologists that there are three modes of apprehension. One, direct cognition through the avenue of the senses, each sense when in use, putting its user into contact with a distant range of vibrations, demonstrating as form manifestation, and two, deduction or inference, the use by the cognizer of the reasoning powers of the mind in relation to that not directly perceived. This is, for the occult student, the use of the law of correspondence or of analogy.
Thank you. That was Heidi, thank you. Okay. So first, herein lies a hint to the more advanced students of this science as to the esoteric problem of the Makara hinted at in the Secret Doctrine by H.P. Blavatsky. So, you know, this is actually belongs to Sutra number 5 in this discussion on Kumara and Makara. So the hint is that to truly understand our own minds, we must understand the cosmic entities who gave us that mind, right? Which is only possible through a realization of our direct connection with these beings. In the esoteric numerology of the Sanskrit alphabet, the letter syllable ma is the fifth letter of the fifth row, thus representing the ultimate condensation of matter. In ancient Hindu geometry and astrology, Kara meant the side of a polygon. Together, Ma Kara literally means a five-sided figure. Okay, the Kumaras are the lords of flame, the solar angels who descended from Venus, which is currently in its fifth round, you know, note the numbers, to bestow the fifth principle, Manas, upon the Lemurian root race. Among the references on Kumara in the Secret Doctrine is the fact that Kumara is a near anagram for Makara, and that both reference Manas, the fifth principle. Okay, so that's a little more of a taste as to their connection. Okay, next up, the Sixth Sutra of Book One, which lists the five modifications of mind. Six, these modifications, activities, are correct knowledge, incorrect knowledge, fancy, passivity, sleep, and memory. According to Patanjali, every possible activity of one's lower mind can be found among one of these five modifications. Since we'll be discussing each of these at length through the upcoming commentary, we'll just continue. There exists a vast field of knowledge which the seer must cognize at some time or another. It's generally conceded among occult psychologists that there are three modes of apprehension. So before AAB gets into an analysis of correct knowledge, which is the first of the five modifications, she here pauses to explain how a human being apprehends information, beginning with the most concrete method. First, direct cognition through the avenue of the senses, each sense, when in use, putting its user into contact with a distinct range of vibrations, demonstrating as form manifestations. So, as the provider of the raw data to the lower mind, the physical senses are, for an incarnated person, the most used mode of gathering information, with each sense being a highly specialized receiver of a specific bandwidth of vibration. When a particular vibration hits the corresponding sense organ, the brain translates that vibration into a sound, a color, a texture, a taste, or smell. These lower senses provide data about the physical shell of the universe, but are unable to provide an experience of the causal reality that impulses that vibration. The next level of apprehension comes through deduction or inference, the use by the cognizer of the reasoning powers of the mind in relation to that not directly perceived. This is, for the occult student, the use of the law of correspondences or analogy. So deduction is the active use of the lower mind to build a logical bridge from the known to the unknown. A person observes physical effects and reasons backwards to speculate on the unseen causes. Since the universe is fractal-like, and thus uses the same structural geometry for both the macro and microcosmic reality, the occultist is able to use the as above, so below principle as a higher form of deduction in order to imagine those levels of reality that lie beyond his or her scope of direct experience. For example, in building the Antikorana, we visualize the process by drawing our content from the discriminatively informed imagination. Excuse me a minute. Any thoughts or questions so far? So she's going from the most dense to the most abstract here. Starting direct cognition, then detection, and next, can we have a reader, please?
Yes. Chris, can you read that for us, please? Oops, I guess Chris is gone. Okay. Marina, can you read that for us, please?
Yes. The direct cognition of the yogi who sees, centered in the consciousness of the self, the ego on its own plane. This is achieved through the right use of the mind as an organ of vision and transmission. Patanjali says, the seer is pure knowledge, gnosis. Though pure, he looks upon the presented idea through the medium of the mind. I would love to repeat it again so I can actually, get the more feeling of it. The seer is a pure knowledge, gnosis. Though pure, he looks upon the presented idea through the medium of the mind. Book 2, Sutra 20. Deduction is not a sure method of ascertaining knowledge, and the other modifications refer primarily to the wrong use of the image-making faculty, imagination, to the self-induced passivity of the mind, a condition of semi-trance, and to the retention of thought forms within the mental aura through the use of the memory. Each of this is now dealt with in a separate sutra by Patanjali.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so first up, the direct, this is a third sutra. No, it's not the third sutra. It's the third point being of cognition. So we had the senses, and then we had the deduction, or so direct cognition, deduction, or inference, and now the direct cognition of the yogi or seer, centered in the consciousness of the self, the ego, on its own plane. So now we've graduated beyond personality levels altogether. This is achieved through the right use of the mind as an organ of vision and transmission. So to achieve direct cognition, which is what's being described here, the yogi must become soul infused, which allows them to shift their polarization entirely out of the personality and center it within the causal body. When this has been done, and when the mind has stilled the five modifications, of course, that would be a prerequisite for this, it becomes an organ of vision. The mind itself becomes an organ of vision by which the soul perceives the outer world. See, again, you might think, oh, we're looking upward into the higher realities, but this is all soul based process. And our and what we do in this is just clear the veils between us and the soul, and then the soul takes over. And our identification with the soul means that we are part of this process. And the vision is the means by which the soul perceives the outer world, right? This then is the soul living and breathing and moving within the lower quaternary, seeing the outer world. And becomes an organ of transmission of the higher realities to the physical brain. So both are happening. When the disciple reaches this stage, they are truly, quote unquote, in the world, but not of it. But this is not yet the stage where the intuition is employed, for direct cognition is still a subtle, highly refined duality. There's the yogi, the seer, looking through the lens of the higher mind at the truth, the seen. It is perfect, unclouded spiritual vision, but it is still vision. That is one, point A seeing point B. The observer and the observed are separate. But true intuition doesn't use an organ of vision because there is no distance across which to look. With the intuition, you do not see a truth. You become the truth through vibratory unity with that truth. Next, Patanjali says, the seer is pure knowledge, gnosis. Though pure, he looks upon the presented idea through the medium of the mind. So, despite its high state of purity, the indwelling soul, who is the seer, as here used, has not yet achieved identification with spirit. However, though still separate, it does perceive the archetypal blueprints of the divine plan by looking through the flawless, transparent lens of the higher mind. Thoughts or questions? Next up, deduction is not a sure method of ascertaining knowledge, and the other modifications refer primarily to the wrong use of the image-making faculty, imagination, to the self-induced passivity of the mind, a condition of semi-trance, and to the retention of thought forms within the mental aura through the use of the memory. Each of these is now dealt with in a separate sutra by Patanjali. So, though deduction and imagination are powerful tools, they aren't sure methods because they operate from within lower manas and the astral body, and thus fall entirely outside the realm of truth. For example, deduction requires working from premise A to premise B to reach conclusion C, right? It requires time, separation, and logic, and can thus never compass the pure geometric and synthetic vision of the soul. Okay, I saw a hand.
Nisa, go ahead.
Well, I, coming out of the tradition of metaphysics and specifically mental science, I kind of, this whole idea of what level you're functioning on, to me, is a sign of, it's a way of discriminating if you've fallen in with the wrong crowd, so to speak, because there are mental science people who are very powerful and they speak not of spirit or soul. And to me, those, you know, it's all what you see then is they're functioning on that in the world of effects, I would, you know, I would label it. And yeah, rather than groups and teachings that say, you know, look to your soul, look to your higher self, look to spirit.
Yeah.
And it's a good maybe benchmark, I don't know, but it would be a good way to determine if you are with like-minded people or just posers.
Right. You know, there's tremendous personality potency that can come through the purifications and disciplines of the mind, right? And so it looks like success. It is on a personality level, right? The key point is that you shift from being the positive pole as a highly mentally developed being, a positive pole of your personality, to the receptive pole for the soul. You open yourself to the magnetism of the soul, and thus you move from the third aspect at its highest possible development, which is mental acuity, right, of the lower mind, which can be developed extraordinarily, right? You shift from that to being passive, to being receptive, a receptive agency of the magnetic draw of the soul. And you literally quiet the mind, you still the mind in order to take the next step forward. And, you know, I think, you know, I don't know the specific, you mentioned one of the disciplines with science. It's not, you didn't say Scientology, but one of the other ones. I don't know the specific agenda of that. Which one did you mention, Nisa?
Well, I come out of like the tradition from Ernest Holmes and Nona Brooks. Like the Nona Brooks was divine science. That was what my grandparents were into. Uh-huh. And my mom was into Ernest Holmes. And then my aunts were all into unity, which all comes out of Christian Science and Mary Baker Eddy and the Fillmores and all those people. And they're all, you know, and they were all, I think I've mentioned before, Ernest Holmes in The Science of Mind mentions Anna Besant. So I just know that all of them were thick as thieves. Whereas right now you have people who are remote viewing and just groups that are, when they present their manifestation powers, it's all about, you know, manifesting in the world of appearances and the world of effects. It's not, there's no mention of, it's all just about what you, the personality, can.
Right, appearances.
Yeah.
And, you know, like I said, the appearance of success is tremendous. In fact, in some ways, it's easier to, quote unquote, succeed because you're working with a very familiar milieu, which is mind, right, with his the third aspect, the form aspect, you know. And so if you focus in on that, you can make tremendous progress seemingly. But at some point, you know, ultimately that leads into the I want to qualify this statement, but no, I'll put it another way. It doesn't lead into it. I'll put it another way, which is that the Dark Brotherhood, the Dark Lodge, focuses on mental development. And they have, DK says that there's unimaginable levels of lower mind mental development, but what's always lacking is the love principle. So, you know, you have to judge for yourself whether a particular movement. I don't think, you know, these movements are moving in that direction. They're just oriented towards the mind, you know, and you have to yourself decide what, you know, from a vibratory assessment, you know, where these particular groups are oriented, you know. But for us, as students of the Master DK, you know, it's, you have to develop the lower mind. It's definitely part of the process. You know, and that's part of occultism, developing the mind, you know, at the, you have to move out of astral orientation and become mentally polarized at some point in your process of becoming. This doesn't, that's not the same as intellectually polarized. Intellectualism is the activity of the lower mind. So at some point, you have to use the mind as a conduit between the soul and the brain, you know, and that's how you break out of what you've been describing, you know, these different movements. And I don't know them well enough to say that with any kind of absolute knowledge, but if they don't include soul contact, then, you know, they're almost certainly oriented towards development of the mind and of the cities that come through mental development, right? The powers that come to one. I think, for instance, Scientology would fit in that, but I won't say anything more because I don't want to be sued. Okay, next up. Whoops, what did I do that for? Here we go. Yes, can we get a reader, please? How are we doing? Or about, you know what? Let's pull the plug here because it's, you know, we're going to be ending in 2 minutes and we need to announce dates and such. So let me quickly look at the chat, see if there is anything. Some people have had technical problems. Huh? Okay. More than one person. What happened? Is the screen blinked out for a minute but came back on?
I didn't see that happen, but I heard your voice get a little squirrely there and then it came right back. And I don't know if it was your internet or my internet because I have flaky internet sometimes. So, yeah, more than one person did have an issue with it. But
yeah, it's hard to know. It could be the internet connection, you know.
Can I say how it looked to me? Because it looked to me like the screen completely went black a couple of times.
But just for a minute, right? Oh, yeah, and Marianne said it was black here for a while. Huh. Yeah, I don't know what to make of that.
And Ron said he had an issue too. So, yeah. Sorry about that.
It's, I'm not a tech person. I couldn't even begin to try to trace that down and tell you why.
But I didn't see it on this end.
Okay. Yeah, it really makes it peculiar then. Okay, dates for the next things. I know that this Friday is the 8th of May is the first of two Treatise on Cosmic Fire webinars for May. And you want to announce the secret doctrine?
The secret doctrine will be on 17 May.
Okay.
And the next Light of the Soul will be on 7 June.
Okay. And the second Treatise on Cosmic Fire will be on the, let's see, 15th, 22nd of May. That's a Fridays, two consecutive Fridays. The big announcement is, though, don't think that the conference is over. It's not. We're only halfway through, maybe a little more than half in terms of days, but we have two big conferences coming up. I announced this in the beginning, but and I'm really excited about the content for these coming post-conferences. Really interesting material we'll be covering. So yeah, sign up for those conferences in June. Do you have dates for those? I don't. 14th or something like that.
It's June 11th and 12th, and then June 13th and 14th. So it's June 11th to 14th.
Okay, well, there you have it. Thank you, Mikhail. All right, well, that'll do it for this time. Much love to you all. Thanks for participating. It means a lot to me. I think this is really worthy material. I think some people thought it was going to be more mystical, you know, light of the soul, and maybe were put off by the AAB's approach because it's very in depth, you know. But it's right down my alley for sure. So,
I like it.
Well,
Thank you so
in
much.
DK, oh, DK tells us that we all have to go through that mystical stage before we do the occult stage, as you were talking about earlier, because that's what separates the left hand from the right hand path, is developing that love content that you do as the mystic.
That's right. Yeah, you know, you keep occultism incorporates mysticism. It doesn't, you know, you don't go from one to the other. You include it in your process. You know, basically, you know, the mystic goes out to have an experience of God. The occultist has that experience and then comes back to earth and serves, right? That's the one of the definitions of the occultist who it's a practical yogi, you know, who's oriented towards salvation of the race. But anyway, much love to you all. Take care. Bye bye for now.
Goodbye, everybody, and hope to see you at the Esoteric Astrology and the Seven Ray seminars coming up in June.
And TCA
Bye.
Friday. Bye bye.
Yeah.